When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Fresher than hoe, riddle me that. The rest of y'all know where I'm lurking, yeah. Can't none of y'all mirror me back. Yeah, hear me rap, it's like Angie rapping his prime. I'm Young H.O., rap's Grateful Dead. Back to take over the globe, now break bread. I'm in.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Miami Nice. I am your co-host, Blake Howard, joining me undercover in a club, listening to the greatest song ever made, Numb Encore by Jay-Z and Linkin Park, is my partner in crime, as always, just scoping out the crowd, Katie Walsh.
I'm ordering three drinks at once, baby.
Three drinks at once. She got a tan in Miami. This is obviously a show that's all about really modern man. We are a horny campfire for everything Michael Mann, pretty much post Ali. And if you're a Michael Mann fan, it's been a momentous week. New York Times bestselling author now, Michael Mann, to add to Academy Award nominee and all those other things. But very recently, in fact, the 20th of July, our guest did an amazing profile on Michael Mann. We've spoken to so many people who've been in his orbit. We've spoken to people who've done countless interviews. You know, Bilge Ibiri feels like a Michael Mannologist at this point, so having him and those people come on the show. But this terrific profile, which is titled Michael Mann's Damaged Men, was done by our guest today. And usually we have a brief of, we're going to talk about a specific scene, we're going to talk about a specific film, we're going to talk about a specific theme, but we just want to hear what it's like to watch Michael Mann stomping around Rome, what it's like to meet the man. Thank you so much for being a part of the show, Jonah Weiner. How are you, my friend?
Hey, doing really great. Glad to be on here.
Well, look, you did a terrific piece, and I think we weren't the only ones probably to see this piece in the New York Times and effusively gush about how great it was, just as a piece, a capture, a snapshot of the man's entire career and how he finally came to this film that we, as manheads, have known he's had in the drawer for like 20 years. So it's so cool that you got to sort of profile him with this in right about to happen, profile him right before Heat 2 comes out in this like new bit of productivity from him post-Tokyo Vice. So it's very exciting. But Katie had the most important question, I think, of anything that we're going to ask today. Katie, can you please ask Jonah? Because we're serious journalists here. So Katie, can you please ask Jonah the most important question of all?
The thing at the top of my mind, I got to know about Michael Mann's drip. I feel like that theme was just like exuding through the profile. I mean, you open with his roomy ombre button-up that bled from green to black with white jeans.
I'm glad
going
to
full Euro.
I'm glad to know that a fellow fashion enthusiast who appreciates man's status as a drip lord, which is not like we're not alone. You know that there are many of us who know that he has been getting off major fits. Apparently, actually, since film school, I was really happy to see there's a shot that he provided of himself at film school that ran with the Times Magazine piece that Blake was just talking about, where he's wearing like this little like black mock neck maybe, and he's got this sort of like, I don't know if it's an unclasped watch or a bracelet, but I mean, he was on, and he's holding a, you know, he's blasting a dart. It just like the swag was on point, you know, back
the
when he
swag
was...
is flowing in this profile. I mean, not only are you describing it so beautifully, but like there was that photo of him, French, 1967 film school or England, wherever he is. And then there's also the photo of him shooting Thief, just unzipped hoodie, no shirt. I'm like, amazing. What's going on here?
It's funny. If I have one regret, it's that I didn't ask him about fashion at all and his fashion choices. For whatever reason, I don't know, if I'd had maybe an extra day with him, we could have gotten there. But I just didn't know. I don't know if, I mean, I'd be really curious because it's clearly, I mean, actually it's funny. We're talking about this in sort of, you know, in a half joking way, but obviously it's not, you know, a million miles. It's not far-fetched to think like he actually would have interesting things to say about how he puts an outfit together the same way that he'd have an interesting thing to say about how he, you know, wants a set to be decorated. He clearly thinks about this stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And function and form and aesthetics all bleeding together. I mean, it has to at least function somewhat in his mind in the same way that he approaches his movies.
Style factors in his movies, you know, even as crazy, like, if folks are listening to Miami Nice, they've probably listened to some of our other shows. But even as recently as One Thief Minute, where we did this sort of remembrance of James Caan and Thief, Jim Belushi talks about Michael Mann, you know, I don't even know if it's even made the cut of what was originally a 4-hour episode. But he was talking about Michael Mann being so specific on a Hawaiian shirt for Jim Belushi's character in Thief, which is this big, it's a white shirt, it's got like these big flowing plants and greens and reds, and it's kind of iconic, and James Caan standing on top of a rooftop wearing a yellow sweater, and it's just like, it's a very drippy movie, Thief. But he was just like, he said that this lady just bought countless rolls of fabric to man in countless different shirts, and he's like, no, it has to look like this. No, just over and again. And she finally found the thing that he had in his mind's eye, and he goes, yeah, that's the one. And he just very specific. And especially on Thief, I have to credit another friend of our show, Jed Ayers, who says that James Caan was born to dominate top buttons. So I imagine if you're on Thief, the low zip hoodie with the chest hair out is just, it's kinship with your star, right? Because James Caan...
The shoulders on James
Caan. He cannot, a top button will never connect around his neck. It's just not. It's chest
doesn't
hair
stand a chance.
No, it doesn't stand a chance. Out for the count. So please.
I love that. Oh, no, sorry. I was just going to say, like, that story that I hadn't heard about Belushi's Hawaiian shirt and the fabric, I mean, it has its corollary in one of the things that made its way into my piece. So, you know, I was there with him for pre-production on Ferrari. And so what I was essentially seeing, which, you know, I didn't know going into it, you sort of never know what you're going to get, but I was so happy that I got to see essentially, you know, about a dozen or so of the kinds of choices and sort of decisions that you're talking about, specifically actually in the case of, there's like one moment that made it into the story where he's trying to sort of lock in what the wallpaper is going to be in Laura Ferrari, Enzo's wife's apartment. And they've got an actual shot of what the actual one was, but because of sort of IP, they're not sure if they can use that. So the, you know, sort of art department has brought a bunch of alternatives. And they're saying, well, you know, we can make this. And it's exactly what you just described. He's saying, no, that's not it. No, that's not it. It needs to have this. And actually just yesterday, I think, or maybe 2 days ago on Instagram, on the Michael Mann official, he actually posted a shot of that set.
And that apartment.
Of that apartment, and it's exactly the wallpaper that it, well, I don't know about exactly, but it looks pretty close to the original thing. So somehow they worked it out.
Please tell us what it's like to just be around him in pre-production. This is the thing that we always hear, that he is one of the hardest working filmmakers around. He kind of goes into this mode, production mode, and maybe sleeps, we're hearing like 4 to 2 hours a night. He's so on top of every department and every decision, and he's just like a whirlwind. And the people who work around him know that he's got massive expectations, and they know they're in for long hours, and they know, but they're like, he's here before us and he leaves after us, and we actually don't know when he sleeps, and we're sleeping 6 hours a night, and we have no idea how he does it. So can you please just tell us? Because I'd be so interested. And just to ask, like, when you got this assignment, were you a fan? So, and was that crazy?
Where should I start? I guess I'll start with the last question. And by the time I'm done answering it, I'll forget what you asked, and you can ask that again. But maybe we'll hold it in mind. Yeah. Well, no, he's someone whose movies I have a very kind of clear memory of seeing The Insider with my dad when that came out in the theater, and both of us really loving it, being blown away. And in hindsight, The Insider is in certain ways sort of an outlier, you know, sort of tonally and in terms of subject matter, in terms of things he's made. Off the top of my head, is it the only one besides Ferrari that actually has its roots in, you know, a real story?
Ali. The big
and
one,
Ali,
the,
of course.
The big one is Ali, yeah.
Of course,
And he abandoned another project, we learn, to make The Insider. He was just like, the real life story was more interesting. He was friends with some of the participants.
He wanted to do something else on Lowell Bergman, and then he's like, hang on, this other, right. But so sort of, that's kind of when I'd probably seen Last of the Mohicans before that and loved it, but I was sort of too young to really let it sink in. And so this memory of seeing The Insider and really loving that and kind of remembering just the name Michael Mann, you know, on the screen, and for, you know, that sort of lodged in my brain there. And he's the kind of person that I, even when, he's the kind of guy who's, a lot of his movies I love, some of them I just love watching, even, it's sort of both as a writer and kind of just an appreciator of a certain level of craft. He's the kind of guy where even if I don't kind of love a movie in a certain way, he's the kind of guy where I just want to rewatch them over and over and over again, because there are things that, I guess it's a version of love, or it's a different kind of love. Like Miami Vice would be, the movie would be a classic version of this, where it took kind of 4 watches for me to just kind of realize. And I think Bill Gabeary wrote a great thing about this, where he was kind of like, you need to realize that what you're watching is kind of a dream. You know, the way that man is going to tell this story is just going to behave in certain ways that if you're going into that movie, with too rigid a set of expectations, you might not sort of receive just sort of like the brilliance of the weird choices that he makes, and just kind of, why is the camera drifting like this? Why is it over there now? Why are these characters out of focus, etc.? So he's the kind of guy that, all to say, I love so many of his movies, and I'm fascinated by all of them. And that's exactly the kind of person that I love writing about, because there's a certain, you know, artist or filmmaker specifically who I might sort of love all their stuff, but I don't know exactly what I'm going to get out of a series of interviews with them. The last director I profiled before Mann was David Fincher, who very similarly is the kind of guy who can tell you why everything in the frame is there. And that's a really fun person to write about, because without sort of demystifying anything, they're not sort of pulling the wings off the butterfly. They sort of relate to what they do and all their choices in this highly systematized way. And they'll tell you, I'm using this lens because it connects to the themes that I want to explore in this movie in this way. You know, and they'll sort of like just be able to sort of, I don't know, demystify sort of the creative process in a way that I like when I'm writing about anyone, but certainly when I'm writing about movie makers. And so I had this sort of dream in my mind that at a certain point, it'd be great to write about Mann. And over the last couple of years, I mean, your podcast, both this one and the previous one, is absolutely a part of this anecdotal sense that I got, that I think just sort of throughout his career, there've been sort of waves of rediscovery of him and, you know, new generations kind of diving in and kind of falling in love with him. And that, I don't know if it's the vagaries of like what HBO Max just puts on the homepage, and suddenly 2 million people have watched Miami Vice who hadn't seen it the night before. But it seemed like, you know, like there's this momentum building around him, you know, and like gifts of Heat, you know, circulating on, you know, on Twitter, whatever it is, kind of getting the sense that the sort of I don't know, the ground was being laid for another, you know, Michael Mann reappreciation.
To your piece, though, I felt insane in 2015, 16 when this idea gestated to do it. Katie and I obviously became friends. We've started this show now a couple of years ago, so it feels kind of crazy. But even we marvel at the GIFs and the memes and the stuff. We're just like, a fire has been lit and it's burning uncontrollably. And we just check in on it from time to time, like, wow. Like, it, look at these kids. They're going absolutely nuts. It's so fun. We've even talked to the orchestrator of ManFacts, a lot of it on the internet. And it's just like, we don't even understand. And I'm like, I don't understand what you kids are doing, but holy shit, I love it. Just keep doing it. It makes me smile every day when I go online. It's crazy.
Yeah, and it's nothing like, there's no hard data. You can't, you sort of have to just sort of point in all these different directions, but you can't, I mean, who knows, maybe, you know, HBO Max probably has streaming numbers, but it's like, I don't know, it's just this sense that sort of a zeitgeist thing is happening, right?
Yes.
It's so funny when I feel like we started the Miami Vice podcast, like right before people were like, you know, really like latching onto Miami Vice or expressing their love for it. And I remember we posted the art for our podcast and we were like, coming soon, Miami Nice. And my DMs lit up. It was like, oh my God, you're doing a Miami Vice podcast. Oh my God, I want to, you know, guest. I need to talk about this movie. And I was like, whoa, what? Like, I was not expecting this. Like, reaction. You and I were just like, hello, like, let's just have a funny podcast about Miami Vice and like drink mojitos and talk about this movie and kind of have a laugh. And then it's turned into this like sort of church of Miami Vice.
Yeah, a confessional.
Absolutely. Yeah.
A confessional.
Yeah, the confessional.
So you get a chance to talk to him. Obviously, you talk to someone like David Fincher. I think I love what you said there is because there are so many filmmakers who, I think there's kind of the great, some great filmmakers, like I don't know, they're kind of like, I want to call them like magical, like David Lynch, who like doesn't seem to have all the choices. Like, there's that great clip that's online everywhere and people use it like, do it again, but good. You know, like he's that kind of like, he's not a Michael Mann or a David Fincher. And then there's someone like, you know, the great Mark Ruffalo story with Dave Fincher is like, they're up to like take 36 or something like that. And he walks past Ruffalo and moves an extra and then walks back and taps Mark on the shoulder and goes, good job. And he just goes back to the video villaging action, and Ruffalo's like, it's not even me, I'm gonna kill myself, I don't know what's going on. But so you get to Michael Mann, obviously, and I think that you, based on your piece, and I've read it several times now, it's just the, I don't know, there's something tactile in the piece that you find is like, Michael Mann in Europe makes sense. It like feels like there's like a whole community of people in the world who for the longest time have been like, he's there, like, he's their American auteur. Like, there's a huge French, you know, a proponent of this as well. Jean-Baptiste Leray, who's like one of the best film critics and lecturers in France, has been a champion for years. He's like, screw Chris Nolan, Michael Mann's the greatest American auteur. I don't care what you guys say.
Is that Mirage du Contemporain? Horrible French accent. Yes. He wrote that, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. There's no English translation right now, actually. No.
We're dying for the English translation.
We've got to get an update. Actually, so nice. Michael Mann sent Bill Gabiri Mirage de Contemporain, and it, like, but the French version, and Bill is like, I have to learn French to read this. Like, Michael probably knows French and knows multiple languages. But
I don't know. It's just funny. I know that because he sent it to me too. I think he at least really likes the images in it, and sort of, but because there are these sort of great juxtapositions. It's not just stills from Mann movies. So there's a universal language, even if you don't know French, to that book.
Ooh, that's
a good point. Yeah, no, I think Jean-Baptiste was particularly talking about the airport scene in Heat and the airport scene in Bullet. And saying, so if anyone, you know, he actually told us that on the show. So yeah, he's unbelievable. He's writing on Miami Vice, Gravity, The Flux.
Oh, cool.
Speaks for itself. Yeah. If you've never read it, you guys are listening to this show right now. It's the first time listening. There is an episode with Jean-Baptiste Leray. Just type in Gravity of the Flux in your browser right now. If you want to read one of the truly best pieces of film criticism you'll ever get around to reading. So you get this profile. And you get to be the insider with Mann himself. You get to go and visit his crazy method.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, essentially kind of getting this. So right. Step one, realizing or sort of deciding, boy, he'd be the kind of guy who just sort of, whether or not a reader knows about him or cares about him, it's the kind of guy where you're going to learn so much about filmmaking and kind of just all the decisions that go into making something good. So deciding that, getting this sense that there's, you know, between the GIFs and your podcast and all these other little sort of data points, you know, getting the sense that there's sort of something zeitgeisty happening around him. And then, because a place like the New York Times always wants a news peg, the arrival of Heat 2 sort of offered that kind of quote unquote news reason to do it. And actually sort of, so the piece gets assigned, Mann signs on to do it in the context of the release of Heat 2. And then it's sort of, while we're kind of plotting out the reporting schedule, that the financing comes together for Ferrari. And suddenly, instead of going down to Santa Monica to spend an afternoon with him, you know, at his office there, the proposition becomes, do you want to come out to Modena, where they're going to be shooting, the hometown of Ferrari. And it's going to be for, you know, pre-production. So, you know, part of you says, well, boy, it would be really fun to be there when they're shooting, you know, a scene from the Mille Miglia, you know, one of these car races. But actually, to your point, what wound up being really, you know, sort of so much fun, and I think lent the piece a lot of the texture that you're talking about, was that he's in pre-production when it's things like the wallpaper, all those decisions are being made. And so they've commandeered this extremely, there was no drip to Katie's question, no drip to this office, the most like bland sort of like fringes of Modena. It wasn't a beautiful building, just like, I think it was like the headquarters, like one floor was like the headquarters of some kind of regional chain supermarket. And they're on like the floor above that or something. And they sort of commandeered this like very nondescript, you know, sort of drop ceiling office space. But what's so cool about it is the halls are lined with all these archival and scouting photographs from, you know, the Maranello Ferrari factory at the time, the barbershop where Ferrari used to get his haircut in the 50s, his apartment, you know, locations where the race was run. And so you actually sort of walking, you know, shots of Adam Driver in Ferrari's apartment. So you're kind of walking through the movie in this sort of like very, you know, preparatory research kind of phase. You sort of walk through the entire movie because they've got it laid out physically, just, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of photos just lining the hallways. And so as you move around from office to office, you know, you're sort of walking through, you know, some of the raw materials for the movie. So I'm seeing all that and I'm sort of tagging along with him. The scene that's in the piece is he's talking with location scouts and production designers and art directors about essentially where they're going to shoot. You know, so much of Modena is unchanged. And so it's sort of this wealth of opportunities for to kind of like, oh, wow, the barbershop's still there. And the only thing that changes is the sign. So sort of making all these decisions. But yeah, I mean, it's true. The wallpaper is one example that I really loved where he's like, yeah, you've given me five options and none of them do it because there's something about the sparseness and the weight of this green that I need. So you're sort of like watching him kind of there. Then the really cool thing on some like geek shit, I wish I was more of a car geek. I would appreciate this even more, but they're rebuilding something like 9 to 11 actual Ferraris because they need to destroy them. And so if you got your hands on an actual, you know, 1957, I don't know, 250 worth, or whatever it is.
It's worth so many millions of dollars.
Of course.
They never insure it. They would never insure it.
Not allowed.
So they're rebuilding these cars.
They've all got Toyota engines, these cars, because they're going to crash them. They're just building these beautiful husks around them.
And you're seeing him. I mean, so here, this is like a level of geekiness that I love in my reporting. And I always have to realize, like, this actually probably is like a step way too geeky for the feature. But one of the things I love about your podcast is like, there's nothing, no such thing as too geeky. I mean, sort of love what you guys are doing. You know, I've listened to a bunch of the episodes and I have to almost restrain myself from listening more because I would like lose maybe, you know, I don't know, a year of my life just listening to them over and over again. Because like I've listened to a few of them, but like that one with the sound designer who's worked on his stuff. Like, I love that. And I just sort of love what you guys are doing with this project where you can just fall down these rabbit holes as deep as you want. But yeah, so he goes to talk to the people who are essentially in charge of overseeing the recreation of these cars. So they're doing full 3D body scans of the actual Maseratis and Ferraris that competed in the race that the movie centers around. And he's talking, he's got sort of spreadsheets about logistics. Cause they, I mean, it's staggering when you think about the enterprise and what I'm about to say is multiplied like a dozen times over across a production as enormous as a Michael Mann movie. But like these cars are getting made in the UK. They need to be shipped over to Italy. There's customs questions. So they've like everything has been sort of scheduled down to within an inch of its life because it's a well-oiled machine, right? No pun intended. And so there's all these spreadsheets about, okay, this car's going to be done on this date. And in the meantime, man is saying, okay, but hang on. When I was shooting Collateral and, you know, with the taxi cab, and when I was shooting Miami Vice with the Go Fast boats, we realized, sort of too late, kind of when we were shooting, that there are all these kinds of problems about heat sensors on cameras. And if they're too close to the exhaust on a vehicle, or they're not kind of on springs to deal with vibration, you have all these problems. So he's telling them right now, this is the stage where we're not only recreating Ferraris, but we actually have to redesign them to accommodate sound and light boards and cameras and all this shit. And the guys who he's working with are like, oh yeah, right, hadn't thought of that. So I'm saying I love that kind of thing. At a certain point, I think a reader's eyes might glaze over, and I just have to focus on his ombre shirt, you know, things like that. But you know, just to give you a sense, you know. And then a kind of a more lively thing that made its way into the thing is, he was so generous with me because he's sort of, you know, he's commandeering the ship, but he still sort of like would turn to me and kind of do a little sidebar and sort of explain, okay, what I'm doing is X, Y, and Z right now. This is what you're seeing. And one of those things was, he was just saying, you know, look, these details, like the wallpaper or whatever it is, not sort of technical details, but aesthetic details, are so important because they all go into the ultimate effect. I mean, I'm not telling you guys anything you don't know, but the ultimate effect that a viewer, consciously or not, is going to take away from this thing. And he talks about doing the set design and set decoration on Manhunter and how getting the kitchen chair right for Francis Dolarhyde's home, you know, and he's like telling whoever was working on that, like, no, this kitchen chair is not crazy enough.
I know. I love that quote. Like, find me a psychotic kitchen chair. And I'm like, God, what does a psychotic
what
kitchen
chair
What
section of IKEA do I go to for the psychotic kitchen chair?
But I absolutely love the lead that you went with for the piece, which was, I found, you know, illuminating in a lot of ways, because it's illuminating in his attention to detail, which is about the rhythm of the windows in the Ferrari factory, and they need to go like do 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 and then break or something, you know, whatever it is. I have the piece up, I can pull the quote, but the fact that he's so attention to detail oriented, but that it is all about what the eye is doing for the viewer. And so I was like, wow, that's fascinating to hear him talk about that. But it also, it was like revealing all of these different things about him, not only as a technician, but as an artist and as someone whose films ultimately are about affect and feeling and emotion, and as technically perfect as they are.
Well, no, you're exactly right. I mean, because I think one thing that's embodied there is one of the things that really I find sort of endlessly fascinating about man, because it's almost, I mean, it verges on paradox sometimes, sort of this exacting attention to realism, you know, that sort of has to come into a certain tension and compromise with artistry, right? And sort of saying, you know, at a certain level, when do I decide that the way that the windows were arranged on the actual Ferrari factory in 1957 is sort of insufficiently musical, you know, and where can I, as Michael Mann, sort of, you know, sort of bend what it actually was? And, you know, I mean, his sense, again, as we've established, it's only the third time that he's done something situated in real life, but I think it's true. He wants that veracity in any story he tells. And so the question is sort of like, when do you risk becoming sort of hidebound by a slavish sort of devotion to accuracy, to the degree that sort of, you know, hampers artistry? And that's just something that he does so well, and it can make the movies just feel so strange, because there is this sort of blend of the absolutely earthbound and then the kind of hallucinatory, or, you know, I don't know, the expressionistic, and that little moment, you know, kind of gets at that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's something as simple as, you know, a lot of people have been talking about Thief recently, but it was like, Quentin Tarantino, actually, finally, in an interview for his podcast, they were talking about another Mann movie, and he's like, the influence of they're both acclaiming the influence of Michael Mann. They go, the one big thing, just to such a small detail, and I think it goes to the dreamlike quality, the shooting in Chicago, and Mann, as a young man, had grown up and taken photos, and that kind of the spark of this creativity, this like unconscious thing of like wanting to be a filmmaker but not realizing he wanted to be a filmmaker, is just walking around his hometown taking shots and creating these evocative images. And he's like, didn't know what he was doing, thought he might want to be a photographer, an artist. And then he's like, oh no, I want to make films. And so even something as small as, everyone who's watched Thief will marvel at the kind of insane neon reflections of Thief, car lights, street lights,
the wet cement.
And they're just like, if there's one tiny thing, not only how influential he's been, it's like Michael Mann relentlessly wet the streets of Chicago when he was shooting it. Just at night, just wet them constantly. Never raining, just wet, like wet down the streets. And like every filmmaker after 1982 is like, man, that looks, why does that look so amazing? It's just wet the streets because he wanted more options for the light to reflect off of it. And it's just like, that's the dream. It's like, I'm here in the spot that I want to shoot it. I'm on this very specific, you know, Chicago street. I'm on this thing, doesn't look right. I need to maintain the dream, and the dream is the wet streets. And then that just gives it this eerie quality, this elevated thing. And, you know, sometimes it's with music or visuals or those little aspects, but I just think that's what's kind of shocking, because usually you meet super creative people, but they're not very good at a spreadsheet. Michael Mann is like a king of a spreadsheet and the king of that specific, like that level of specificity. And then also will be like, no, I don't like the rhythm of windows. Like that's why he's such a wonderful and like boundlessly interesting person and filmmaker, because he can do it. He can seemingly do it all. And it's, and again, you mentioned Fincher as well, but that's the kind of guy, like Fincher, technical guy, worked in Industrial Light and Magic, knows all this, you know, Soderbergh edits, caters, you know, drives the bus for his own movies. Like these, there's some of these characters that just like seemingly can do absolutely every aspect of the filmmaking and really attend to them in with as much care as they do. I think that they just become so fascinating, because like, how are they doing? How are they keeping ahead of all of this?
It's funny you mentioned Soderbergh too, because one of the most fun things about reporting that Fincher piece was I got on the phone with Soderbergh to talk about them, because you know they're friends and they show each other cuts of their movies and things like that. And I mean, two interesting things. I'd have to bring up the piece to remember the exact quotes from Soderbergh, but one was I asked him, what's your favorite Fincher movie? And he said, without hesitating, Panic Room, which was, you know, a rare choice. No disrespect to Panic Room, but it's just sort of not, you know, in most people's, you know, top three for Fincher. But he's like, because the degree of sort of difficulty, sort of the challenge. And it's funny because actually Collateral, I'm sure you've gotten into this, but sort of Collateral functions similarly for Man, where he's sort of done something enormous and then he's like, you know what, I want to do something very small and contained, and then realizes, oh no, this was a mistake. This is actually so much harder to sort of paint, you know, try and paint within such a rigid constraint. You know, Soderbergh is saying just like the level of difficulty that he set out making a movie like Panic Room, just like, I think something like, give me a panic attack, you know, myself, just trying to envision making that movie. And so part of it is him being kind, but I think that there's sort of like a level of exactitude with even Fincher that Soderbergh is like, bro, I can't be there with you. Like,
I think it might even be in your piece that I quote to people all the time, which is like, because they share the same floor of the same office building and he just walks next door and they hang out because they're close friends. He's like, sometimes I've gone into his editing suite and he's just like, they're looking at 100 cuts and he's like, no, I can see the camera, like, for any human being except him, the camera imperceptibly like slows on the track just for a second. He goes, no, that's a bump in the track. Next. That's a bump in the track.
Absolutely.
And Soderbergh's like hyperventilating. He's like, I gotta go. This is too stressful. You stress me out.
To compare Fincher and Mann, because they both have this sort of level of sort of technical, you know, sort of exactitude. Fincher, though, is so much more interested in perverts than Mann is, you know.
Yes.
Like sort of perverts show up in Mann stuff, and a kind of like Wayne Grove character, the Wardell character in Heat 2, if you guys have read that, and they're kind of aberrant, and they're sort of, you can tell he's sort of icked out by them, and they represent the sort of chaos that Mann really does not want to let into, you know, sort of his universe. You know, it's sort of, it's the anti-Macaulay, you know, Macaulay and Hannah obviously are just sort of like have this kinship. And Wayne Grove is sort of this aberrant perversion. Whereas like in Fincher movies, it's all Wayne Groves, you know?
That is such a good point. I had never thought about, but like, I always say that Mann movies are like, I mean, in the dumbest way possible, Mann do job good. And like, and you talk about him, you know, that directors make films about surrogates for themselves and, you know, people who are professionals and engineers. And, you know, there is a balance between the perfectionism and the romanticism of Mann in his protagonists especially. And I think that's the balance that we love and crave, the juxtaposition between that. Mm. But But so it is really funny to think about. It's like, oh, aberrant perverts. But or even the guy in Manhunter.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can never remember his name. One thing I was going to say, going back to the Fincher and Man of It All, I love the quote you include from Nolan in the piece, which is, you feel like you're watching a film about experts made by experts. And that's like a feeling that I crave in, especially in rewatching films. I love the feeling of being held by a film. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm like, I know that I'm in good hands. I love how I'm holding myself right now. But that's the feeling that I crave, is like, I want to know I'm in good hands. I want to know I'm in the hands of a professional, or like, and even if I don't know what's going on, like, that they know what's going on. And so I will find out eventually. I don't know. It's a sensation that I really need in a movie, that like this person knows what they're doing.
I think about that both as an audience member, but also actors. Like, when you're sort of on set, when you can't, you know, you're not seeing the edit, you're not seeing the finished thing. Think about the trust there, like, just in terms of being in good hands.
And that they will draw a good performance out of you no matter what. Probably your best.
Are we in a safe space for an embarrassing confession?
Absolutely.
This might be the least safe space for the confession I'm about to make. But in that quote that you that you talk about from Christopher Nolan, I love that quote, right? Experts move about, experts made by experts. He's talking about this tiny detail in the bank.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Robbery, which I have seen Heat maybe, I don't know, shy of 10 times, you know, which is a lot of times to see a movie.
It's okay.
Blake has seen it a lot.
Yeah, I've seen it a few times. And what I would just say to you is,
oh, sorry,
it's okay.
Some people are like, you know where I'm going.
Some people are like, Blake, I've seen it, you know, three times. I'm like, it's fine. I'm a lunatic. It's fine. You know,
I share your lunacy. I mean, I sort of, especially when I'm researching a piece, I watch movies multiple times. You know, by the way, side note, what I really love doing is watching movies with the commentary, not for the obvious reason of kind of getting the commentary, but for watching the sort of storytelling happen without any dialogue and sort of just seeing what the camera's doing. But anyway, so I'd seen Heat, you know, X number of times, and I had, and this isn't just my shameful confession from Miami Nice, I had never actually consciously noticed the detail that sold that entire sequence for Christopher Nolan, which is Kilmer. I mean, I'd sort of seen this motion happen, but I'd never clocked the sort of significance until Nolan sort of pointed my attention to it, which is they're in the bank vault in the bank heist, and all, you know, the stacks of $100 bills or whatever are kind of in these, you know, large bricks sort of that are shrink wrapped. And Kilmer in the vault wraps a duffel bag over the brick, flips it over, but then takes an X-Acto blade or whatever it is, slashes the plastic and bangs the bag so that the brick of dollars will fall out of the kind of the rigid rectangle and take the shape of the bag. And maybe it's because I've never thought about robbing a bank or something, but sort of like that, the absolute sort of like zeroed in minuscule sort of reality of if you're a thief, no, this bag's got to go over my shoulder, so I've got to cut this plastic. So that, I'm just, anyway, Nolan had sort of identified something that I had just totally missed.
I don't think that's an embarrassing confession. No,
thank you.
That's you need a better, you need a more embarrassing one by the end of this episode.
Way more embarrassing.
Because I had a, that was a revelation to me too.
I mean, and I guess that speaks to say something sort of trite but true about men, that speaks to the sort of like the layers and layers and layers of what's going on, you know, even in a scene that we've rewatched on YouTube, you know, 20 times. Yeah.
It's funny that when I first finished high school, as like a personal anecdote, I was working in a DVD and at that time VHS distribution warehouse. So it was the end of VHS, was moving into DVD. And I worked in the factory and I picked up that scene because I used to be a guy who used to hand shrink wrap these big pallets of flat cardboard boxes. And also when you were taking apart stuff, you had that little X-Acto knife in your pocket. You lived in your pocket. Right. And in fact, you had to sometimes like get different pairs of shorts because you forget to close your X-Acto knife and it would just cut straight through your pocket and you'd lose it down your pant leg. But it was like, I just remember that bit. I'm just like, oh, of course, because it's so like, what you can turn this big, like easily, you know, a huge 6 feet high, you know, pallet full of cardboard boxes. If you don't shrink wrap that bad boy, you can push it and the whole thing just cascades and falls down like crazy. But if you shrink wrap it, it is a brick. you can run at it and it would you could hit it and bounce off it and fall onto the floor. So it's funny how those little things clock. But yeah, exactly. Like that's one minuscule second of that momentous scene. But it doesn't surprise me, Nolan.
And you start wondering, like, how did that even get into the movie? Like, where does that come from? And is it you know, a bank robber who consulted on it? At what point does Mann tell Kilmer to do it? Is it Kilmer's idea? And there's just like a zillion of these questions throughout his movie.
It's because they were robbing that bank that day, and Chris Chehalis, aka Val Kilmer, just had an X-Acto knife. He needed to get that money on his shoulder. No one will ever convince me they didn't take $13 million that day. for the budget, they just took that extra $13 million. Oh man, it's but yeah. So let's get to and I think your piece does this so well. Stomping around the streets with Michael Mann. Let's go back. Let's circle back to his fashion. Let's circle back to the textures of
having
Italy.
Wine at lunch,
wandering
oh
around.
Oh my God, a man after my own heart. If anyone wants to just sort of have a good interview with me, propose wine at lunch.
I love that you include that in the piece where he's like, glass of wine. Like, I like to think about the way profiles work and the editing process. I'm sure there was a lot that hit the cutting room floor on your piece, but I like to look at the pieces, the details that make it in and how they affect the feeling of reading it.
Well, I mean, I can probably answer both. Speak to what you just said and to what Blake just asked, but like part of the reason that that's in there, I mean, it's this tiny little moment, but one thing that I really liked, and this might be about sort of a certain intimidation on my part that I brought to the reporting experience before I was with him. I was like, this is a guy with an extreme suffers no fools kind of aura around him. And so I want to do my best to not be a fool. And so partially for that reason, and I'll get into kind of how that manifested in some of the interactions that I saw in the pre-production office, but just that little wine moment was one moment. I think there's some others in the piece where it's kind of me relaxing a little once I realized that he's a pretty easygoing, kind of funny guy and warm guy. He's like very mentally, he's sort of generous. And it could be, you know, I caught him on a good day. Obviously, I'm not a reporter. I'm a reporter. I'm not like an employee of his. So, you know, that's going to change behavior in certain ways. But I was really happy with sort of like this kind of looseness. You know, and that was on a Saturday too. So he was probably chilling out a little bit as well after his work week. He was probably really looking forward to that wine. He's probably going to be pissed if I said no. yeah. But there was this sense of like warmth and easygoingness and kind of a sense of humor about him that I wanted to kind of get in the piece. And, you know, that wine moment is a tiny little, you know, kind of.
Yeah, it does warm him up a bit. And not that I wouldn't expect him to be warm, but yeah, we talk a lot about his exacting nature and stuff. So it's nice to see those moments where he lets his hair down.
What was the wine?
Oh God, you know, it's in my transcript. I'd have to look it up. I'm not a big enough wine dude to know.
Well, we're going to get it. And I think Katie and I, in honor of this chat, we're going to have to just swill it. Maybe at one of our next shows, one of our next live streams.
Swordfish and wine.
Swordfish and wine.
And so, yeah, so he, you know, he's sort of very warm and maybe by that point also, it's sort of, I always love doing, you know, Blake, the three of us were talking, you know, just before you recorded, and you were talking about kind of how I agree with you, how cool of a job it is in its, you know, most ideal version, to just spend time in orbit with people making things. I love, generally speaking, well, A, just to watch work happen. Whenever I do a profile, it's the number one thing I always ask, sort of whatever intermediary I'm talking to about sort of negotiating access, I say, I really want to watch work happen. And one of the reasons that I like doing that is it decreases the amount of kind of writerly bullshit that I need to bring to a piece, because sort of we've all read these profiles that, you know, a writer through no fault of their own had very limited access. It's a junket, it's an interview at a hotel or whatever it is. And they've got to sort of, I mean, this is an example that I always repeat, but they've got to like pretend that the way that this person holds their salad fork at the hour-long lunch that they were at is somehow a window into their soul. And I kind of, I don't know, I recoil at that. It's nice that he ordered wine and that says a little something, but I don't know, is that a window into his soul? Not really. So I love seeing work happen, love seeing creative decisions happen. And there, I think he was in a good mood, A, because it was Saturday, but also just because I'd been in his orbit. I just sort of like, I wasn't an unfamiliar quantity because the day before I'd been with him at the pre-production offices. And I do think that it was sort of interesting to see, it was only a few hours that I spent with him following him around. You could kind of see a degree of, I don't want to say fear exactly, but an apprehensiveness on the part of a lot of his collaborators about kind of living up to his standards, you know, and you could just sort of see that in sort of very minuscule ways. But, you know, it was the first time that while I was there, it was the first time that the people in charge of like the photo vehicles, so all the kind of period, you know, there's a train in the movie, not just the race cars, but like Enzo Ferrari's personal Peugeot or whatever it is, or, you know, streetcars in the back of a scene, all those sort of like vehicles for photography, the team that was sort of charged with presenting him with those options, they hadn't met with him yet. It was his first time meeting them. And you could just sort of see the stage fright that these guys were doing their presentation essentially to a very demanding CEO. And he's just saying, this car doesn't work, this car doesn't work, this one's great. And he's also, I mean, one of these brains that's so nuts, because he's sort of talking about the I don't have this brain at all, so I'm going to botch what I'm about to say, but to give some flavor, he's talking about like the combustion engines. He's like, no, that Peugeot wouldn't work because it's this kind of engine, and Ferrari's tooling around town. I mean, sort of like the level of expertise that he's even bringing to things like that was so funny. But yeah, you kind of got this sense of a certain apprehensiveness. And there were a few times where I could see there was a bit of a language barrier. A lot of the crew was Italian, where man would kind of repeat something a fourth time and the collaborator wasn't getting it. Oftentimes because of something as innocent as just sort of a language barrier. And you could see man just sort of like, you could see the patience diminishing. Not that he ever got sort of rude or anything like that. Certainly not in front of me. He might do it, you know, and there may be stories out there, you know, certainly when it's like when the clock is ticking on production. But
I would imagine that would be with someone he's got a relationship with. If yeah. They weren't up to the standard, work with him. Because these guys, all women, filmmakers who are out there have a crew. Mm-hmm. Like they assemble their heist crew to pull off this movie. That's what they do. And you have the people that you trust.
And you can see it, like Janice Polly, the location scout on this one. Location manager goes back to Last of the Mohicans, right? You find your people and that's you find your Mike Chirico.
I'm not going anywhere else. And then if there's someone that works with them. Katie, do you remember the acronym that Jaffet told us, Colin's assistant, when Michael asked him to go and take some photos? And
acronym?
There was an acronym, an acronym that he was using when he asked Jaffa, it was one of the assistants, he goes, oh, you're from, because he was a local for Miami Vice. And he's like, oh, I'm a local. I know this town or I know this thing. And he goes, oh, can you go take some photos? And so he just went to take like very bland, you know, photos, no composition, no thought of light, no angles, nothing. And he brings them back in the office and Michael just like scribbles on the corner of the photo printouts like bad photo or like terrible, like he's just like terrible. Do better on the next one. And like he goes, eventually what I started to get is that much like the experience of this kind of living collage of an office that you're walking through, this kind of like almost like a Michael Mann zoetrope of a movie as you walk through it, but I just imagine that like even for those location scouts, it's like give me the cinema of the shot to inflame my inspiration. So yeah, it's funny, but Michael Mann working with a whole crew over in Europe with more freedom outside of the bubble of a like Los Angeles feels right to me. That feels awesome. It's like he's just dispatched them. Let's go. Come on.
And it's going to be, it's fucking nuts how enormous of a production this is going to be. And it's sort of like, these are movies that don't get made very much anymore, you know, sort of at this scale and telling this kind of story. I mean, the other thing is I was thinking about it. I mean, to the degree that you guys are curious in talking about sort of Ferrari, it might be in certain ways the kind of closest surrogate for man in some regards of any character that he's, you know, kind of built a movie around, because sort of you have, I mean, in a way that's relevant to sort of someone like Frank and Thief or Neil McCauley, he's an engineer and he has that engineer mindset. But specifically here, it's about sort of command. Well, actually, no, I guess there's some other parallels with McCauley, but sort of commanding a crew to pull off something very elaborate in the pursuit of your vision. I mean, that's sort of Ferrari through and through. And without spoiling anything, there's one moment in the script, the Ferrari script, this is not a spoiler, I won't ruin anyone's enjoyment, where it's a tiny little moment where Ferrari is just looking at a schematic of a car engine, and there's a right angle in the schematic, and he just takes a pencil and he just makes it a bend, and he says, it's more beautiful and it's more efficient that way. And I don't know if that's kind of a line that Mann wrote or if that's in Troy Kennedy Martin's original script, but it's so perfect that it's in there, because you have that sense like it's both more efficient and more beautiful to just have this line curve rather than have it be a right angle. I don't even know why I brought this up, other than like Ferrari was an interesting project to sort of see Mann really get revved up about. And that's before I even knew that he used to be an amateur race car driver himself.
He has so many levels of expertise. It was like kind of shocking. I'm like, even listening to the details in the piece about him understanding the engines and the way that they sound and these like archival recordings of these engines. Like, I'm like, this guy knows so much about so much. It's nuts. Like, and even just what you're talking about now. But and it is interesting to sort of start thinking about the parallels between him and Ferrari and why he might be drawn to a character such as this.
Yeah, totally. Oh, and I'm sorry, before I forget, because it was the first thing you mentioned and Blake brought it up again, white sneakers, white jeans.
Yes.
I'm doing a full bottom-up fit check for Michael Mann in Italy. It was a very summertime in Italy kind of outfit. Yeah, these like white Echo, kind of like golf sneakers, actually. I looked them up. White jeans, and then yeah, this kind of like very strange shirt that was like three different colors at once, sort of bleeding.
Amazing. Yeah. I love the white jeans and the crazy shirt. But I also was going to say about his crew, like I think someone in our Discord mentioned that he's working with like an all new crew. Like he's never worked with Eric Messerschmidt, the DP, before. I think the editor is a new person, so it's also interesting that it's going to be like a completely new, so kind of getting used to each other. And I'm sure it makes sense that all of the Italian crew would be like a little bit nervous, you know, because he demands a level of perfection. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's like, step up to the level and that I'm bringing. And that is such a rare quality all the time.
There was this one funny moment to that point when he was in this meeting with the people who were sort of choosing the cars, not the Ferraris, but sort of, you know, the ones that I mentioned before, they're going to kind of populate, you know, the backgrounds of scenes and things like that. And he tells them, so, you know, watch some movies, watch some Italian movies from the 50s and get a sense for the percentage of how many bicycles, delivery trucks, and sedans are in the back. He's like, I think it's going to be mostly bicycles and pedestrians, some delivery trucks, not that many cars. And one, it's like a young Italian guy who's talking with him, and he says, so look at Fellini movies. And Mann was like, no. Vittorio De Sica, you know, like, come on.
He's like, watch all the De Sica movies and count the bicycles.
Exactly.
No. We're not doing Fellini. Fellini's a dream. Go Rome, exactly. Open city, baby. Bicycle feet, that's what you want to see.
I don't want, maybe I'm imputing some disdain into the response, but I was like, bro, Fellini, come on.
Yeah. Yes. We have to educate the children.
That's if we do nothing except educate here. But I think what's fascinating is, and I think this is, it's the confluence of two projects, and I think it's what, I think you got it, Jonah, in your piece is, and I think maybe, Katie, this is me just sort of hypothesizing, but I think maybe that's what it is with Ferrari, with a new crew, is because when I spoke to Mann for One Heat Minute, what we know now is obviously they're in the depths of doing that iteration of Heat 2. Completely different writer, co-writer was working with him at the time before Meg Gardner. They'd been working on it for roughly 7 years, what we understand. So this is, you know, going back now to 2015-16-ish from when it was originally sort of kicking around, which is weird. Like the universe was just sort of, it was all happening. It'd been working out to this point. And what our crew of people have got is, you know, and again, some of our amazing people, our amazing listeners. And if you don't, you need to get on our Patreon so you can come join the Discord chat. We might get Jonah, we might just give Jonah a freebie so he can come in and talk to us anytime he wants to talk man drip. But our fans point out that this Ferrari script in so many different iterations or alterations, bigger scale, smaller scale, etc., trying to be made over the years, has been gestating for like 20 years. And so I feel like that might give man the confidence because he's so sure of the material. Like I remember a couple of friends remarking after listening to the man interview that I did going, man, how is this stuff so vivid in his brain? Like, how does he remember this? And what you then can realize is like, oh, he's been pouring through his own personal archive of his experience to draw on for his creativity. And so you get to something like Ferrari and it's like, it's been living. It's probably been up in pre-production and then down and then up and then down and then up. And then another project pushes it out of the way. See ya. Collateral. Here we go. You know, like wherever the finance was breathing, people confident, not confident of him doing bigger projects. Ali successful. Okay, we're going to do Ferrari. No, it's Collateral and then Vice and then whatever. So what I really think is fascinating, but also like kind of heartening is like some folk who might go, oh, Ferrari, that's a bit strange. It's like, this is a project that he has persisted. And so, you know, all that stuff about the engines and this, and I want you to look at this, I want you to look at that. These must be thoughts that are just pouring out of him. Whereas if you were looking at him and you're like, oh my God, this guy's like a savant, he probably kind of is. But I think that living with something for 20 years and being so sure about it, it's like, oh, you know, this is the perfect time. You're at the tip of the spear. I've got the confidence I can take a new crew. With the confidence I can shoot it on locations. I've got the confidence to do it because I've literally been living with it and agonizing about why it hasn't been made for 20 goddamn years. So I imagine that that's the point that you're seeing him, which is just unbelievable. It's the best possible outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. It was, yeah. And that's it's also, he had this insight into that character. I mean, talk about things that he's been living with for years. He raced Ferraris in an amateur capacity in the, I think it was the 90s or so, I'd have to double check the piece, but he said, I sort of learned something there's a quote where he says, essentially kind of like, you'll be sort of doing laps and there might be, you know, you're doing 70 laps and on lap number 68, you just put together on a level of sort of like, sort of, it's not muscle memory, but in a kind of pre-conscious way, you just put together the right sequence of turns and you feel totally integrated. You and the car are one, in a non-trite, in an actual way, just sort of because, you know, the thing could kill you, right? So you're going however many miles an hour. And he said that gave me this insight into this character who sort of is comfortable making unilateral decisions because he's sort of known from his youth this sort of sense of an absolute sort of integrated eye. And that's an archetypal man protagonist in a lot of ways, the sense of a person who makes unilateral decisions because they really have such strong knowledge of self. But yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know, that was just one example, sort of riffing off what you just said, that like he's sort of had that knowledge of, boy, you know, if you took a character who's a race car driver, you know, they would kind of relate to the world and to other people maybe in this slightly, I don't know, solipsistic way because of that experience that I remember having behind the wheel of a Ferrari. Just a really tiny thing that I don't know if you guys have already talked about Heat 2 as it relates to Miami Vice, but I was just so stoked to geek out for 2 seconds with you guys about how the Ciudad del Este stuff that, of course, winds up being such a small part of Miami Vice became this whole section in Heat 2.
I don't know if Katie's have you read that yet? Katie okay. Hasn't read it.
I haven't read it yet. You can spoil it. It's okay.
No. It's not even a spoiler. Just the section spoiler takes place.
But that's so cool.
Setting.
Yeah.
It's a huge setting. It feels like if you were looking for the connective tissue between Chris Chehalis. Also, this is the commonality. Colin Farrell, Val Kilmer, the hottest people alive in their day. You know, can yes. we just say like Val Kilmer 95, Colin Farrell 2006, as hot as it gets.
I know.
And just, you know, dripping with cool and hotness and mystique and all that stuff. But yes, Ciudad del Este, that it forms the setting of like an entire segment of Heat 2. And so when you're reading it, if you're a Miami Vice fan, you're like, oh, this is my shit. This is I'm into it.
All research that he did for Miami Vice. So that's another cool thing. It's sort of like it didn't make its way into that movie, but it's still in his head.
It's there.
And it's going to make its way into another project, hopefully, right? And that's one case where it actually does. He was talking about, you know, months that they spent doing social engineering in this, you know, lawless sort of, you know, tri-border city, where really just like capitalism at its most ruthless, you know, there's like no street crime because street crime is illogical, you know, it's sort of bad for business. When there's murders in this town, it's because someone was fucking with someone else's money, and you know, that's it. And he spends all this time there, and then it's like, I think it's distilled into almost like one shot of just like all the styrofoam through like a car window.
It's a couple of styrofoam streets shots, yeah. Like late at night with Jesus Montoya, Archangel de Jesus Montoya, driving his car, and it's the USB flash drive for right. Jose Euro. So John Ortiz's character, like, it's just a couple of people transporting a USB flash drive to do sophisticated counter intel is like all you see, and it was meant to be, you know, the centerpiece of you know, the ending of the film.
But that so cool. Those couple of shots feel so informed and lived in and authentic. And when you listen to the commentary, you can hear him talk about all the research he did on, and we talk about this on the podcast sometimes, like that he will be like so dedicated to like you said, the windows and especially in Miami Vice, it's like the street art and the murals. He's like, everything is perfect and from a specific place and transported to another place and all in service of something and deeply, deeply researched. So that's awesome. I'm excited. I got the audiobook of Heat 2, so I'm excited to listen.
Who's
to
reading
it?
I wonder.
Someone named Peter Giles.
Okay, Peter. I wonder what his Pacino's like. I gotta listen. I'm just keen to listen. I've read it a few times now.
I just thought it would be a fun way to take it in, but yeah.
I saw a tweet. I can't speak to this, but someone was comparing the narrator of the audiobook to the very sort of like archetypal in a world.
Oh my God. I can't wait.
Oh God.
Could be perfect.
Could be perfect.
Yeah.
Chris Shirless powers up to a Las Vegas casino.
I feel like there's a lot of Chris Shirless love on the timeline right now, which I'm happy to see.
There's a lot of Chris Shirless.
It might just be all of Roxana Haddadi's tweets, which I definitely appreciate, but there's a lot of Val love out there, which I'm always in support of.
And excellent.
And the same sentiment that I had is like, it's so exciting that they're going to make a movie. Mann has already said in actually an interview with GQ that, you know, Katie and I were fearful, Jonah, like, please, for the love of God, don't do digitally de-aging. It feels antithetical to his incredible, I don't know, he's just something about that rabid believability of authenticity that is in his films that I'm just like, if you put a digital mask on people, it's just going to hurt what's going to happen. So we're like, cast it. And my thoughts are always like, look, if you go to a contemporary example, Moonlight, which won Best Picture, which is an absolutely outstanding film, had three actors playing the same character and it was fine. We all understood audiences are not stupid. It's fine. We get it. They also recast Marlon Brando in The Godfather Part 2. If Marlon Brando can be recast, it's fine. Okay? They found a kid named Robert De Niro at the time. It turned out to be pretty good. But I'm just saying, like, it's patently ridiculous for anyone to go, no, they can't recast it.
Oh my God. They'll do an extensive casting process, and I'm thrilled to see who they choose.
It's so tough to think of who's that.
Yeah.
Who's got that Val Kilmer 95 blonde hair, dangerous, sexy, cold. It's a tough hang to be in that audition room because Michael Mann's going to be like, nope, not it. Nope, not it. Nope, not it.
By the way, to that point, the one thing that sort of one question that I have sort of along similar lines, having not seen House of Gucci, but having seen a lot of people make fun of it, this notion, this kind of classic notion of actors speaking in English but with Italian accents to play Italian people. If there's one director who's gonna, I don't know, like play Adam Driver a bunch of footage of maybe Enzo Ferrari speaking Italian with, speaking English with an Italian accent and getting him to lock that in, it's gonna be Michael Mann who can do that. But that is one question mark, isn't it?
Driver was great. He's Italian. Like, you haven't seen, Katie and I have seen House of Gucci.
I've seen House of Gucci like three times. I'll talk about it for hours. I love it.
on the brief digression is, he's fantastic. Like, Driver's, I mean, He's a fantastic actor.
I think that movie's great.
He's a fantastic actor. No, I like it.
I'm ready to love it.
I like
you
a lot
should,
of...
You should watch it. It's so good. I actually think Jared Leto is fantastic.
Jared Leto, the only way I could describe it, this might be an Australian phrase, but I just go, he's on one. He's absolutely on one in this movie. He's absolutely...
That's an American phrase,
he's
too.
He's on one. Yes. He's absolutely on one. So I don't know if it's an Aussie.
And so is Gaga. It's great. But yeah, Gaga. No, it is weird when, like, there are scenes that they're speaking English and Italian accent, and then, like, there's this scene where they, like, he crosses the border into Switzerland, and I'm like, why are I don't know, they're speaking something, and I'm like, wait, what? None of the language choices make sense, but whatever. I forgive you, Ridley.
But Adam Driver, he had to speak in like that Spanish Latin accent, which he did a brilliant job in Martin Scorsese's Silence, and then he has done accent work there. And I just feel like he's a man guy. He's, you know, I mean, when Martin Scorsese calls, yeah, when Martin Scorsese is like, he might be the best actor of his generation about Driver, I'm like, that's a pretty burdensome endorsement. If there's any endorsement that's like amazing and make you feel good, but also extremely burdensome, it's when Scorsese is like, you might be the best actor of your generation.
Yeah,
it's
like, thanks, Martin.
Marty. That was awesome. Okay, cool. Nothing to live up to or anything. Just one of the greatest filmmakers of all time.
And I want to be very clear. I wasn't actually even sort of casting a sidelong glance at Driver's ability to do it so much as kind of like in a man movie set among Italians, you're almost kind of like, why didn't they all, you know, like Jake Adelstein, Ansel Elgort, learning Japanese, right?
We've praised that yeah. so much. We love the multilingual nature of Tokyo Vice and people just slipping in and out of different dialects and speaking in different languages and then going from English to back to Japanese. I can't get enough of that. I'm like, absolutely. This should be more, like, take more time. Do the, you know, if you're going to go spend X amount of $1 million on a production to do it, like, make it right. And they did a fantastic job with that. So yeah, it'd be interesting. I feel like it'll be moments where, yeah, I think man will, like, if he was ever going to be learning Italian or doing scenes in some scenes in Italian and things like that, I think that they're going to do it. But we haven't even talked about the most exciting thing, which is, you know, when we talk about man, you know, a lot of it is like professionals, but he also knows how to put some of the most horrendously attractive women of all time on screen for us. And Penelope Cruz in a Michael Mann film, it just might be the convergence of all of my dreams. I might just say that right now. It's like Penelope Cruz, Michael Mann, Italy in the 50s. I'm like, oh, talk about, wow. Just, I can't wait.
It's going to be beautiful, isn't it? I mean, just that shot of the of her bedroom that he put on Instagram, you know, with the wallpaper. You can actually
see her. She's on the right-hand side. She's on the right-hand side.
And like, the camera must be outside of the window because, like, very blurry on, like, one of the monitors. You can see her face. And, it's just going to be this word is going to sound creepy in the context of Penelope Cruz. I'm not, you brought her up, but it's going to be sumptuous, isn't it? Right? Just like rich, that green wallpaper. And I don't know. Yeah, I can't wait.
She's going to be incredible. I just love to see her in a heightened state. I feel like she'll be like in a heightened state, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense.
That's her wheelhouse. We want her in that heightened state, berating the living daylights out of Adam Driver. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Hopefully the memes are better than, you know, Marriage Story, you know, the Marriage Story Adam Driver memes where he's just like banging and on the wall and stuff like that. We might even get a new batch of those, which is going to be exciting.
We might, because again, no spoilers. It's a matter of the historical record. There are some fights between Enzo and Laura.
there's going to be some stuff. Look, Jonah, thank you so much for taking the time to geek out. Your piece was absolutely outstanding. This has been super fun to talk to you. We have not really talked about Miami Vice, but we were just so excited to you know, get another man acolyte on and someone who's got your eye, because I think that that's what's fascinating. I think that that's what our listeners get fascinated about when we have guests, is that people have had FaceTime with Michael Mann and seen the creative process. And I think that you talked about it, which is just like, that is the reward. It's like you watch some shows and you watch some things, or you see, like, you know, especially in a contemporary sense, you see like bad CGI or bad choices and you see a cut corner, and in a Michael Mann film, a film might not resonate with you. You might not like a characterization, but every choice is so labored as like a labor of love. Everything, every choice of restaurant, every choice of fashion, every choice of music, you know, the harmony of windows, like, who the hell, like, amazing, you know, these things just to get what's in front of us and for it to render and just to percolate and just be this thing that you just want to slow cook in your brain. So that's what I loved about your piece. It was so great. It's so awesome to talk to you. And just thank you so much for coming on and chatting to Katie and I, because, you know, I think the drippy Michael Mann chat is probably what people is going to be the highlight for. But no, just hearing you talk about this collage of, you know, living film, and I'm going to make my wife listen and just keep pitching that to make, you know, my house an homage to Heat in the same way, you know, just having, having pictures of Michael Mann films all through the yes. house. I mean, and she'll just probably say, keep it in your office. Okay. Keep it in the studio. It doesn't need to be in the home, but it's just fantastic to talk to you. And thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, thank you guys. Truly knowing that the piece passed muster with you two goes a long way. You know, it means I didn't totally fuck it up. So thank you.
No,
so much.
No, you totally didn't. You said as much in an email we shared. You're like, it passed muster with you, man. I'm pretty happy. I'm like, listen, there was so many other great man fans. I saw Bilger, you know, talk about it. I saw so many of the people that are in our community be like, this is a fantastic piece. This is the kind of stuff we want to see. So no, it's brilliant. So thank you.
And awesome, it's beautifully written and like evocative about his work. So,
oh, man.
Excellent
thank you so
work.
Much.
Yeah.
Thank
you so much.
We'll make sure we link it in the show notes. We'll catch you guys on another episode of Miami Nice just around the corner. Hi, this is Blake Howard, host and producer of One Heat Minute Productions podcast. We dive into the great and underappreciated cinematic works, often 1 minute or one scene at a time. Our crew of guests are some of the most wonderful filmmakers, writers, authors, and critics ever assembled. Our shows include One Heat Minute, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, Increment Vice, and right now, Zodiac Chronicle. Check out oneheatminute.com or find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.